Welcome to Australian Birth Stories. Here's your host, Sophie Walker.
Hi, everyone, and welcome to the Australian Birth Stories podcast. Thanks so much for joining me. Each week, I'll be bringing you mothers telling their stories of childbirth. Let's get into today's show. Australian Birth Stories acknowledge that the practice, ceremony, and sharing of birth knowledge has occurred across the lands and waterways of Australia since time immortal. We acknowledge the First Nations and language groups where these stories have occurred and pay our respects to elders past and present. As we continue to share stories together on these unceded lands, we try to listen to the knowledge and practice that has always existed here and consider how we might tell our birth stories in response to country, paying our deepest respects to the traditional custodians of many places across Australia that our children will know as home. Bootie is your destination for soft, simple, and sustainable everyday essentials. After birth, when you're resting, recovering, and learning to embrace your postpartum body, comfort is key. Regardless of your size or shape, your soft core, aching perineum, and healing cesarean scar, you need soft, breathable basics against your skin. Bootie uses organically grown bamboo to create supportive underwear that holds you when you need it most. Alongside their high-waisted full briefs that feature a thick and comfortable waistband, Bootie have just released a period and leak-proof undie, and a must-have for your postpartum and beyond. A pelvic floor weakness is expected after birth, and comfortable underwear that catches the leaks will help you feel more confident in hospital, at home, and when you feel ready to leave the house with your baby. Comfort and confidence go hand in hand, and Bootie is ready and waiting to fill your underwear drawer with the softest everyday essentials. Feel supported, be comfortable, and choose sustainable with Bootie. If you'd like to check out all the products that I've curated into a beautiful fourth trimester edit, head over to bootie.com.au/Australian Birth Stories, and there's even a 15% off code on that page, so make sure you go and check it out. Welcome back to the Postpartum Uncovered mini-series, where I chat to a range of perinatal experts who share their knowledge and experience of postpartum. I hope with each of these interviews, you're encouraged to prepare for new motherhood so you can navigate it with confidence and awareness. As mothers, we're always learning, and it's comforting to remind ourselves that postpartum really is forever. This episode of the series is a must-listen for all mothers, regardless of when and how you birthed. I interview highly regarded women's health physiotherapist Sue Croft, who explains what happens to the pelvic floor in pregnancy, how we can best navigate weakness and prolapse after birth. Sue also reiterates that prolapse is not a devastating diagnosis and encourages us to access guidance from a women's health physio, find perspective, and actively separate our anxiety from our physical symptoms. I also speak openly about my own prolapse and the physical and emotional journey I've been on for the past 9 years. I've gained so much comfort and knowledge from Sue, and I hope the information shared provides you with more pelvic floor awareness. Let's get into today's show.
Well, thank you so much for joining me today, Sue. It's lovely to have you on.
Thank you very much for asking me, Sophie. It's lovely to be here.
Well, as I've explained in your intro, you're a wealth of knowledge and so experienced across all things pelvic floor, so I couldn't think of anybody better to join me today. But I thought perhaps we should really just begin the discussion assuming people don't have a very good understanding of their pelvic floor and explain what it is, because I think until you're in pregnancy and kind of having complications, some people have never even heard of the term.
Yeah, well, the pelvic floor is a set of muscles, a very important set of muscles. And I've explained why I'm here at home and not at work, where I might have been able to show you a beautiful 3D model. And when you go and see a public health physiotherapist, all of the physios will have a 3D model. And I think it really is nice to position and see how the muscles work. And they're quite expansive and they sit at the base of the pelvis. And they provide the support and the floor of our bodies. So when the term pelvic floor exercises, everyone always thinks they've got to get on the floor to actually do their exercises. But of course, it refers to the fact that it's at the base of your body. And they provide the closing pressure for our sphincters, so that the anal sphincter to prevent loss of gas and feces, and our urethral sphincter. And they give tone and support to the muscles that give support to the vagina and allow us to have good sexual awareness and good sexual tone. So these muscles are variable in terms of how much they're affected by things like your particular if you have a very small genital hiatus, if you have a very tight set of muscles, if you have a very EDS, Ehlers-Danlos syndrome, where you have a different type of tone to the collagen. And so these are the factors that can affect what your pelvic floor is doing. But of course, the big impact on these muscles in terms of what happens with a vaginal birth. And so if we have a vaginal birth, we can sometimes change the stretch of the muscles. We can change the attachment of the muscles. We can change how strong the muscles are if there's some nerve damage to the muscles. But these muscles are very capable of being rehabilitated. And I think the important message I want to get across today is that when you're going to get assessment from anybody, you've got to have a really good, thorough assessment, which isn't going to invoke a lot of fear and danger messages to you that your pelvic floor is now useless and it can't allow you to exercise and it can't allow you to move.
Yeah. And I mean, I've shared on the podcast over the years my experience. So I think we'll touch on, we can use me as a case study. So I've got plenty to talk to on that issue. But, and I've heard some physios refer to it as almost like a hammock or a sling that kind of holds those organs together. So could you explain to us how that pelvic floor muscle changes throughout pregnancy and sort of what happens at a physiological level as the baby grows?
So we do have hormones which do allow us to deliver vaginally very nicely. And your hormonal changes will start to kick in and you'll notice them right from the beginning when you are first just a few weeks pregnant. So they allow the stretch and enhance the stretchability of the muscles. But there are other things that we can do to facilitate that as you travel through the pregnancy. And so a little bit later on, we might be talking about the value of something like perineal massage, where at 36 weeks, you can start to make sure that you're doing everything you can to enhance the stretchability of those muscles. And there's good research to show that doing perineal massage is going to decrease your risk of episiotomy, decrease the risk of third and fourth degree tears, and just allow your recovery from pain to be a lot smoother and even decrease need for analgesia. So during the first stage of the first trimester, you might notice you've got increased frequency at those hormones that are actually showing demanding of your bladder to go a little bit more urgently. But that's really a bladder issue rather than it necessarily being a pelvic floor issue. And I think that's a really important thing to distinguish, that everyone thinks if you've got a bladder issue, it's a pelvic floor issue, and that you've got to have stronger pelvic floor muscles to not have bladder issues. The bladder is an entity in its own and it's very driven by habit. And one of the things that we know that if you're looking at a urinary incontinence issues and you choose to have a cesarean birth over a vaginal birth, you know, as you come closer to that 45 to 55 age group, people who have chosen to have a cesarean birth over a vaginal birth may actually find themselves having more urgency and urge incontinence and frequency because they haven't understood that the habits they adopt through their life are actually influencing that. So it does matter how often you go. It does matter if you go a lot just in case before you leave the house, when you get to the doctor's surgery, all those sort of little things, quirky things we do with our bladder. And so it's not all about pelvic floor exercises. It's about how do we train the bladder and how do we do things that make the bladder misbehave. If we come to the middle trimester, then this is often a comfortable time for women. You know, they've adapted to those hormonal changes that might provoke nausea and vomiting, which then could have caused them to have some incontinence that's stabilized often. And the weight of the baby, the uterus is growing up. And so it relieves a lot of the weight of the baby as it's going in and up. But when we get to the third trimester, that's where we're suddenly starting to have a heavier baby, and that's starting to cause pressure, and it's starting to cause pressure on the bladder. It can cause changes to the bowel function, and managing really well through your pregnancy bowel, your bowel function is very important. And so there's a definite flow through the three stages is what you perceive is going on with your pelvic floor. But all the time, there is this hormonal influence which is causing better stretchability of the muscles.
Yeah, to prepare you for the birth.
Yeah.
And we touched on then, or we were talking before, perhaps we hit record, about how you can actually have pelvic floor issues and prolapse and things aside from ever carrying a baby. So it's a lot to do with the way that you empty your bowels and, yeah, and as you toilet. Do you see, I feel like we've talked on the podcast, there's such a lack of understanding of the body, and I think it really comes down to lack of education in schools, that women will come to pregnancy and not know, really not have an understanding of their cycle or when their fertile window is. Would you like to see, this is kind of going a bit off track, but would you like to see kind of in primary school and then in high school more education on just simple stuff like toileting? Because if that has it, I mean, we go at least once a day, most of us, and if you are straining and not emptying your bowels properly, it can have long-lasting effects. Would that sort of be a dream of yours?
Well, it's more than a dream. It's actually enacted. The Continence Foundation of Australia has a brilliant program called Toilet Tactics, which schools can invite, you know, ask for the literature about that. Oh, look, it's been my dream for a long time, as long as I've been doing this, because if we start to educate about how children, I mean, we just given a baby, it still amazes me that even now I'm the public system, you get a baby and you walk out the door sometimes 12 hours later. It's an amazing thing, and we don't do anything. We have to drive for 100 hours with supervision before we're allowed to get our license. And so we're handed these very complex creatures, and, you know, each of those stages they go through, we have such a powerful influence. So if a mum has had a difficult birth and might have urgency and frequency of the bladder, she might be training that baby when it comes to toilet training time, which really is around 2 to 3. And they, you know, they're at the toilet at the shops and they say, come on, Johnny, let's you go too. And so they can inadvertently train the child to actually have really poor bladder habits because they've got them themselves. And so I think that understanding of the rules around, you know, what we should do with our bladder is very important, that we should go with a bouncy full bladder. We don't not go at all. I mean, my kids used to burst in through the door at 3 o'clock and race for the toilet because the toilets might have been disgusting at school. And, you know, or someone, another child, not mine, but, you know, they might be intimidated when they go into the toilets by somebody. And so they just defer and won't go until they get home. And so overholding with your bladder is a big problem as much as, you know, going too frequently. So it is something that, and probably much to the horror of my girls, I used to go to the school and do some education about bladder and bowel. And you could tell the ones who were awkwardly just thinking, oh my goodness, where can we get on and do something else, than the others who were intently listening and they had constipation issues or they had some, you know, problems with urinary incontinence. You don't have to be a woman who's had a baby to be wetting. And so daytime wetting in children and teenagers is a very big problem. And particularly if the girls are doing sport like gymnastics and trampolining, like it's phenomenal. It's something between 60% and 80% of girls who do gymnastics will leak urine. So gotta definitely get that. And that's why your podcast is so good. You know, ability, the more we spread the information and allow women to understand about what is important for their child, what is important for them, what's important for their mum. You know, this is how we get the message out and we break the silence that surrounds incontinence and prolapse and fecal incontinence and anal, you know, gas incontinence. You know, these are embarrassing topics that people struggle to raise. And so just being able to sit here comfortably and talk about it and say, yep, if your child is wetting through the day, this is a big issue and you need to go and see someone who has experience in pediatric pelvic health to get some help, because it can indicate there's quite a significant problem. Just before we move off the education, there's a brilliant new program also around period pain that Dr. Susan Evans has started, and it's really talking about how extreme period pain is not normal and educating girls about how to manage period pain and how to go and get help to see that it isn't related to endometriosis. And so, you know, that's a brilliant program that's in the schools. But all these programs take funding and, you know, continence and periods don't get a lot of funding. And so, you know, we need to just keep raising our voices and saying this is incredibly invaluable information.
Well, my background's public health, so it's like if we just get in earlier and earlier and earlier. So well, together, if we're all working towards it, hopefully we'll get perhaps into more of a model. I don't know what their education is. I feel like the Scandinavian countries and France have got much better kind of systems post-birth of really you get that free access to a women's health pelvic physio, and really they're onto it a bit more there. So hopefully we're heading that way. But yeah, definitely. Oh, I feel like I need to get you on for a whole nother thing about toilet training, because my boy is almost four and he's not toilet trained with pooing, so we're crossing that. But I'm thinking, oh, I wonder how I'm influencing that with my own issues. So much. But I'll take us back into the birth space. So I guess we are going to touch on how my first births influenced things for me. But what can we expect from the pelvic floor after birth? This is a broad question for you. And how does it change, and how can we recover?
Yeah. Look, I think the important thing is to understand that age does make a difference here. And so there are some factors that will definitely, if we look at particularly something like levator avulsion. Now, levator avulsion is where during birth, the attachment point behind the pubic bone of one or both of the muscles, levator muscles, meaning elevating, lifting, is partially or completely pulled away from that pubic wall. And so what that does is it means that the hiatus, the actual gap, is actually bigger. And so when we're talking about how do we help prolapse, everyone might have heard about something called a pessary, which is designed to help give support. And pessaries have been around for thousands of years. Women used to use a pomegranate cut in half to pop it in to help support things. So, you know, an old age cube. So it's really important to understand that women have had prolapse all through the ages. This is not a new thing. What's a little bit different perhaps is that women are having their babies older. And so, you know, my mum had her first baby at 19, and yet a lot of girls are having their first baby at 35 and 36. And so as we age, our stretchability of the pelvic floor muscles changes. And so instead of having a big stretch and then a rebound and being intact, the muscle stretches and it tears. So that's probably one of the most significant changes that can occur to the levator muscles. And if we look at the broad statistics, 20% of women, all women who have a vaginal birth, will incur a levator avulsion injury. But it's much heavier weighted as you get towards the older age. So much lower, 15% when you're 20, in your 20s, and it's at up to 50% when you're 40. Over 35, it's 40%. So you can see that age does make a difference as the muscles get stiffer. But there are lots of different things that can happen. And remember, if 20% of all women have a levator avulsion injury, it means 80% don't. And so, you know, we can often get a little bit sucked up into the vortex of when, even as pelvic health physiotherapists, because we see so much dysfunction in our practice, we have to keep reminding ourselves that there are plenty of girls who are having babies and having, you know, really very minimal disruption to what's going on. And I think before I forget, Sophie, I want to really touch on that, because I think that there's been a significant change in the knowledge base of girls through wonderful things like your podcast and other things that are available. And I think that can distort the view for our listeners about and fear about what happens to the pelvic floor during a vaginal birth. So I think that what we have now is we have some very clear risk factors. And so we can look at some people and say, you know, your risk of delivering and having a levator avulsion injury or a third or fourth degree tear, because we go through all these predicting factors and we can say, look, that's pretty minimal. Like, you know, you're not likely to have these things happen, and give the person confidence to say, I can do this and it's not going to totally disrupt my life afterwards. There are others, and that things like if you are 160 centimetres or shorter, if your mother or your sister has a prolapse, if you're over 35, if your baby's head circumference at that 35-week scan is very high, you know, the predictive factor is it's going to be over 36.5 centimetres. You know, these are risk factors that we know are going to elevate your chances that you're going to have some significant pelvic floor dysfunction.
Does weight also factor in? Because I feel like I've always been on the heavier side and I almost feel that my prolapse symptoms get worse if I gain a bit of weight. So is that also a contributing factor to your likelihood? Or?
Well, I think if you think about intra-abdominal pressure, if you're carrying weight around your middle, then there's going to be some increase in intra-abdominal pressure when you bend forward, for example. But, you know, it's not, and I think we've always just got to be very mindful about what can we do to support people who are worried about that. But there's plenty of girls who aren't carrying weight who have prolapse. So it's not as definitive as we would like to think. I mean, obviously, if you're in a morbidly obese range, there's going to be an increased risk. But we can also do something by supporting that prolapse with a pessary. And, you know, that's going to help give support with those more minimal things like, you know, repetitively bending down to pick the toys up. You know, if you've got something in there that gives some splinting, then that's going to be helpful.
I might also share an image when we release this episode of what a pessary looks like, because if you haven't seen one, you might be thinking, what are they talking about? But they come in all shapes and sizes. And I'll do a post on Instagram so people can have a look, and we'll attach a link.
And there are really and truly, there's a lot of different pessary shapes. And we do need all those because we have to, again, in terms of pelvic health physiotherapists, we have to come back and think about our patients as an individual. While I tend to, at our practice, we give a bit of it's like a script so that we know that patients are getting information about bladder, bowel, prolapse, how it happens, what's normal, what goes wrong. Because if we get a referral from a doctor that says this woman has stress incontinence and we just go ahead blithely and educate about stress incontinence, you know, they may not have presented their case symptoms to the doctor very accurately. And so it really isn't that at all. And it really involves something else altogether. And only when we're questioning much more thoroughly that we do as a public health physiotherapist that we uncover what the true problem is. So if someone's sent with overactive bladder, and why just start launching into giving them defer more, hold on better, these are some urge control techniques, let's use TENS, PTNS to help with that. But I don't do a bladder scan and I find out, you know, 3 months down the track, oh, okay, she's actually got 150 mil residual every time she goes to do a wee. So all those things I told her about hold on more are actually a bit of a nonsense. And what you need to really do is learn how to do your bladder properly. So yeah. I think that, you know, coming back to this concept, every woman is an individual. And that's why we have like half of my kids' inheritance is tied up in, you know, pessaries, because we have a lot of pessaries and we have to have a lot of sizes in pessaries. So, you know, when you're looking at someone externally, you can't tell what's going on internally. It's really important. There might be someone who's really a size 8 in their clothing, but they might be, you know, hashtag 9 in their pessary size. And so we just have to understand that, you know, every woman has gone through it, has a different story, a different journey, and we have to actually treat appropriately. And to help us do that, we do measurements so we can actually make it objective and we can actually look and say these are the things that, you know, are going to point us to that pessary or to that treatment strategy.
So it might be a nice time to kind of draw in, not to bang on about myself, but to draw in my experience, and then we can kind of talk through what happens if women are presenting to a women's health physio for the first time, what they can expect, because I think it can be daunting, and particularly if you're doing it, say, I mean, I think usually you wouldn't do it any earlier than 6 weeks post birth. And when your sort of blood loss is finished up, in my experience, I went to a very well recognized women's health physio, and it's important that they've got the credentials. It's not just a regular physio. They've done specialty work in this field like you have. So in my experience, the first thing we did was to have an ultrasound and an internal check. So obviously gloved up and very sterile and in a very professional manner, had a real look both outside the vulva and inside, and tried to feel when you do a pelvic floor squeeze, what's actually happening internally. Do you want to sort of take us through what you would do in an initial assessment?
So I tend to start with the education because I want to get through that education so I'm not really coloured too much about what I'm going to find, okay? If I've got that opportunity to say to someone, this is the pelvic floor muscle here, this is what they look like, And then I've got a little model where I can actually show what levator avulsion looks like. So if someone said to me, like you, Sophie, that you had a over nine pound baby and forceps, you know, my thinking is going to be, you know what, even though Sophie was only 31, so her age wasn't, you know, was under that 35, you know, she's had two of the big risk factors for levator avulsion. So I reckon it's worth going through, so I can say in a really calm way, and I can get out there really quickly to say, look, we've got this left side that is fully attached. That right side might be partially detached. This is what it looks like. This is how it happens. And I can get to say, but, you know, we've got some muscle end down. We might have a little bit down this posterior compartment, and we're going to work on that, and we're going to try and maximize potential of those muscles. So I don't get in there and say, oh, yes, you've got a levator avulsion, and, you know, she's heard a little bit about it, and then she's freaking out and not even listening to anything I'm saying. So I like to go through that education. And, you know, I suppose when I've been doing it for a while, you know, I have some ways to make it a little bit less daunting and a little bit, you know, there's some funny things. And I suppose the other thing is that I'm pretty open about my own pelvic floor dysfunction. And I say to them, look, you know, I've had three NAMP, and I don't tell my children, but I call them buffheads, you know, because they all, you know, what that did for me was give me a really too good an understanding of what pelvic floor dysfunction means. And sometimes I employ people and they say, oh, I haven't had kids, so, you know, and I say, that's okay. You don't have to have my pelvic floor dysfunction to be a great pelvic floor physio. But it does give me insight. And I'm really open saying to the patients, I have this problem. I've got that problem. You know, you can't, I'm going to have worse looking hemorrhoids than you had. You know, I don't, I've lost all my, you know, inhibitions about that because I feel very comfortable in my space. And it's allowed me to do something which I've developed an amazing passion for. But it also is a bit scary when you think, oh, my goodness, this 65-year-old age group thing, this is a new little phenomenon I can add into the mix. And it gives me a true understanding of what people are experiencing. And so, you know, I would say to Sophie when she was sitting before me, you know, there might be this risk that this happens. This is what it is, but we're not going to be fazed by this. We can do this. And we're not going to let it limit our ability to exercise if that's what you want to do. And I think we've all got to remember, all patients and all physiotherapists have got to remember that it's, if we scare people off exercising and moving and being confident about that at 35, you know, they're potentially going to have a completely different life and a completely different health life, because they're going to stop exercising, their bone density is going to be affected, their heart cardiovascular system is going to be affected, their mental health might be affected. And so when I talk to someone, I say, you know, what exercise were you doing and what would you like to do and when would you like to resume it? So that's part of our assessment, is finding that out so we can actually go through that really thoroughly. And so I'm answering her needs. Like if I said to her, you've got a big prolapse, significant levator avulsion, you can't ever jump again in your life and you can't run. And she's almost, you know, on the edge, because she's mental health wise, she's in a terrible space without her running. That's really not being a very good pelvic health physiotherapist. So I educate first really thoroughly about bladder bowel, prolapse, what it means, and then seek her consent and offer her to say, if you're triggered here, because if someone's had a traumatic birth, just having the first vaginal examination might be really confronting. And so if you give me consent, you can withdraw that consent at any time and I will just stop. And I think it's really important for new women's health physios to understand how important it is to offer that to patients, that they must stop if they're not coping with it. And with that examination, yes, it's gloved hands, and I'm being very, very explanatory while I go through this, what I'm feeling, looking. We do measurements where we do a measure of the distance between halfway through the urethra to halfway through the anus, and that gives us this measurement called genital GH plus PB, genital hiatus plus perineal body length. And we've got some nice work now where we can say if that distance is, you know, greater than 8.5, there is a high risk of someone having a levator avulsion injury. We can say greater than 7, there is a mild risk. 7 to 8 is a mild risk of prolapse. 8 to 9, moderate risk. 9 to 10 is severe risk of prolapse. So we've got all this data that's slowly but surely being collected that's quite useful. The advantage of doing that, if you've pushed a baby out and 6 weeks later we measure your distances 8 centimetres. And you go away with the information about doing pelvic floor muscle training, doing your bracing before you bend to lift and pick up the child, before you put the pram in the car. Then when you come back and see us, maybe, and we do repeat our measurements, maybe at 9 months later, we might find that that GHPB length on Valsalva has actually decreased, because you're bringing those 2 points together with your repetitions and with your bracing to stop that intra-abdominal pressure constantly forcing things down. If we do a peritron measurement where we squeeze around a device, and we've got a benchmark for what it is at 6 weeks postnatal. And if you go away and we repeat those again at 9 months, we can say, look, this is how much their squeeze pressures have improved. The other thing, Sophie, I think that's really important to remember is that there is considerable spontaneous recovery. And I think this is not mentioned enough, that let's say you've got a complex baby and you're struggling with a traumatic birth and your mental health is not great, you're suffering some postnatal depression. You know, me saying to you, and you've got to do 30 pelvic floor exercises every day, is very daunting, and it might be just too much. And I think that what we've got to understand as pelvic health physiotherapists, and you've got to understand as patients, is this concept that there can be spontaneous improvement. Don't freak yourselves out. You know, coming to see someone who is recognizing and reading the room about what's going on for that woman to take the pressure off. And if they haven't done anything between visits, that's okay. That we're there to support and encourage and not make people, women, feel inadequate because they're not actually able to fit that in. I remember when my grandson was born, and I was just down there being grandma, and we were trying to go to a doctor's appointment, and I really just stopped and thought, I'm so grateful for every postnatal woman who ever gets to me at 6 weeks. It was such a massive assembling everything. I was there helping. Like, I just thought, this is a big ask to get women out of the house with the baby to do a 6 week postnatal check. So good on all of you who do it, because it's an effort to get out of the house. And I think we need to respect that. Sometimes they're not going to be able to do the exercises or the tasks. And if they focus on one thing, so let's say, you know, someone's having trouble with defecation and they present with a rectocele and they present, which is also called posterior wall prolapse, and they present, you know, the thing we can say, look, I can see you've got a tricky baby. Baby's crying all through the session. Why don't we just learn how to do this position for defecation? We're going to show you how to sit. We're going to show you what the dynamics of your tummy is. And I've shown everything else, but this is all I want you focusing on now. This is your big thing, because that's the thing that's going to stop your prolapse from getting worse. That's the thing that's going to stop you from being uncomfortable all day, because your tummy is bloated and you feel the bowel motion knocking at the back door all the time, but you just can't, the baby won't let you settle to go and relax. So I think that's important. We've got to be good therapists and hone in on who is sitting before us, what can we see, use our critical thinking and saying, if I say do this, 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 and this, and if you don't do that, this is going to happen. Like, that's scary stuff. And I think we've got to stop promoting this thing that if you don't do this, it's very scary and fearful.
I often get messages from people because I have openly shared my experience, and they're like, oh, I'm 6 weeks and I've been told I've got a prolapse, or somebody said I've got a prolapse, and they're really terrified because of the stigma surrounding that word. And they also think it's kind of a lifelong challenge for them. But I'm like, oh, it's early days, so everything's moving and recovering. And also, would you like to touch on the effects of breastfeeding and how that kind of changes and how that can impact the tone of those muscles as well?
Absolutely. So you keep me on task with breastfeeding, Sophie, and I'm just going to mention that I don't think it's critical that we make a big deal about a grade one or a grade two prolapse. And, you know, when I have written my own book on pelvic floor essentials, which I completely changed the prolapse chapter, so that I spoke about in the first part of the chapter about this biopsychosocial management of prolapse, that the fear and anxiety that I see in girls about the diagnosis of prolapse is much worse than the prolapse symptoms. So really, I want us to downplay it a little bit, because whilst we've got amazing things we can do, like, I think that we scare women when we go into too much detail. And sometimes when I see people after they've seen someone else, I think to myself, I would not even have mentioned that to the patient because I know that that's not important. And I also encourage girls, don't keep feeling and looking with mirrors because you don't know what the bumps are. Mm. And so sometimes just not important. And that someone might have a little tiny soft urethroceal, which is right down at the entrance. But because it looks different to what it was, they really panicking badly and it makes them feel anxious and horrible. And so, you know, go and see someone and who is sensible and going to really say, put this all in perspective. How can you push a baby's head that's like this through your vagina without changing some of the soft tissue things that are going on? And yes, there is spontaneous recovery. And yes, we can. It's a new little habit we have to learn now that before we cough and sneeze and bend and lift, we're going to engage our pelvic floor muscles. But that becomes just a habit like we used to cover our mouth with a hand and now we put it up to our elbow. We can do this. No big deal. It's just new knowledge that we have to put into practice and it becomes very much second nature. And what is important is not to go feeling when you don't understand what you're feeling because that then makes you really in a terrible emotional state to deal with your baby and to live with your partner and to function perhaps in your role as thinking about going back to work, all those things are really become terrifying. So breastfeeding definitely does affect hormonally what's going on there. And for some women, I see them at 6 weeks and they are so de-estrogenized, lacking estrogen, that if they had a graze and that wasn't stitched because it was such a mild graze, you know, that tissue can be actually sort of, you know, sticky together. So it actually, you know, the vaginal opening is actually decreased in size. So this is how powerful the estrogen loss during breastfeeding can be. Now that happens very rarely, but mostly it just becomes dry. The vagina becomes dry and the tone of the tissues changes. And so one of the things that you should be talking to your GP about if you've got significant changes with estrogen, and you might even have embarked on attempting intercourse before you've come to see us. Sometimes people haven't, many times people haven't, but if you have and you noticed it was very scratchy and dry and uncomfortable, you know, that's an indicator that you need to have perhaps some local estrogen. And, you know, I'm not a doctor, I'm not a prescriber, but you can talk to your GP about Ovestin cream or Vagifem pessaries to help supplement the estrogen just while you're breastfeeding. And then as soon as you stop breastfeeding, you stop it. Or as soon as you've decreased your feeds enough that you're feeling the change, because it does affect the tone. And dry vaginas are like dry eyes. They're very uncomfortable. And so if you've got a bit of prolapse, you might be much more sensitive to what's going on in your vagina because the vagina is dry. And so if you have local estrogen, that will restore normal lubrication and plumpness to the tissue. Also, it improves the actual tone of the urethral sphincter. So the plumpness of your urethra contributes to the seal that you have. And so if you have local estrogen up your vagina, then that travels to the estrogen receptors and helps to plump up the urethra as well. So the seal is improved, so that might improve your incontinence, that little bit of insidious leakage that you might be having postnatally. But, you know, you have to talk to your GP about that. And the other thing, even if you have a problem that if you have a desire not to use local estrogen, then even using something like Olive and Bee, which is a olive oil and beeswax, totally natural
lubricant.
Yeah, and you can use that as a moisturizer in the vagina. So if you're just so really hypervigilant about your vagina and you're feeling that prolapse, just popping a little bit of Olive and Bee in will lubricate it. And it's like putting eye drops in your eyes. So that will help you feel less sensitive.
Mm.
Just talk a little bit briefly about what happens if you've been told you've got a prolapse and you've felt the dryness and you feel the bulge and you've looked at the mirror. What you're doing is sending lots of messages up to your sensory brain map. And so your prolapse starts to occupy space on that sensory brain map. So our face gets a big representation on the sensory brain map because we've got the senses of taste, smell, vision, hearing. Our trunk is quite physically big on our bodies, but it has a smaller space on that sensory brain map. But if you're thinking, talking, crying, really upset, Googling, talking in Facebook groups about prolapse, 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 all that happens is you're getting this giant representation in sensory brain map, and that makes you increase your hypervigilance and increases your anxiety. So everything we do has got to be to downtrain that anxiety. And you can live a very happy life with prolapse, a very sporty life with prolapse. And I think that message is really important that we get that through, that prolapse is not a devastating diagnosis, and that only if 50% of women who've had a vaginal birth, one in two women, were going to have some degree of prolapse, but only 15% of those women will go on to need surgery in their lifetime. So it's really important to understand that we have to put this all in perspective.
It's funny, I joked recently to my sister, I said, I have a prolapse, but I'm not a prolapse. Like, it's not. Exactly. And I've gotten quite used to managing my symptoms and knowing, like, that often have more of a dragging sort of heaviness sensation prior to menstruating and things like that. And you get to understand your body. But I think one of the most important components, and I feel like I'm always trying to drive it home with choosing your care provider, choosing your birth care provider and your pregnancy care provider is so essential. But also finding a women's health physio to guide you through this vulnerable chapter is so important. And I shared with you before that I went, so I've got a fantastic women's health physio who I'm very competent in, and she did all the things that you have mentioned. And I did do the pessaries initially when I was breastfeeding, and we did all of those tests, and I still do Pilates now, but I have heavy periods, and we've kind of looked into different reasons why I'm losing a lot of iron and things like that. And my GP said, why don't you go and see a gynecologist and an obstetrician? I've had all my births with midwives, so I've never actually had ongoing care with an obstetrician. So I went along to the person that she recommended, who was rushed at the end of the day, I think, and just sort of said, oh, well, you need to get a Myrina in. And then, you know, as soon as you can get 6 weeks where you can have time off your feet, you need to get a full hysterectomy. And I knew enough to know that that's not always, I mean, it's a huge surgery to undertake when you're looking after three kids, but I also know that that's not a foolproof answer to prolapse. So I didn't return to her, but I just think that's a good example of the first person you talk to might not be the right fit for you, and they might not have the best advice for you either. So if you have an experience like that, you can always seek a second opinion or try somebody else.
Yeah. Look, there's a few messages I want to get out about that, is that we know the research tells us the younger you have prolapse repair surgery, and I'm assuming she's including hysterectomy to help your prolapse as well as deal with your periods, heavy periods. And so she's going to do a repair at the same time if you've got prolapse. The younger you have that, then the more likely it is to fail, because you just got to, it's got to work for a long time. And so we've got some amazing things in Australia, and I'm just looking, getting the name right, Australian Commission on Safety and Quality in Healthcare. Okay, so Australian Commission on Safety and Quality in Healthcare. These are documents that are set up for women to understand about a whole range of different things. So there's one on third and fourth degree tears. And Natalie McConaughey is a brilliant women's health physio. She's out in Western Region in Dubbo. She was the physio who was invited in to talk on that, and that offer her expertise. We have one on mesh, and we may have heard there's a lot of drama about mesh. And so we have one on incontinence, we have one on prolapse. Now, if you look at those documents, Sophie, they say when you have prolapse, when you have incontinence, the first thing you can do is, number one, is nothing, okay? Nothing. Now, as a pelvic health physiotherapist, I don't like that very much, because I can do lots of things to help. And so I don't want to do nothing. That's what maybe you should have heard about. Okay. That's the first thing you should have heard about. The second thing is conservative management. And that is lifestyle changes, seeing a pelvic health physiotherapist, pessaries. And pessaries can work for incontinence, and pessaries can work for prolapse. So third thing, after you've done all of those things, is surgery. Okay. So I think the important thing is to say that you want to have exhausted everything before you choose the surgery. And that's why, you know, I think it's an important message to get across, that having a hysterectomy is not necessarily the answer. And there's lots of ways to manage heavy bleeding. And so if you're asking, anyone's asking my advice, if you need a repair, you know, urogynecologists have got that extra layer of expertise in terms of doing operations that have been explored. What is the actual anatomy of your pelvic floor now? So you might be asked to do a 3D, 4D ultrasound to see, is there any extent to this levator avulsion? What is the extent of it? Because that does affect how the surgeon does the operation. And you'll be asked to do perhaps something called urodynamics, which is testing of the bladder to see. Because if you've got a prolapse and you reduce that prolapse with surgery and it suddenly exposes that you actually have stress incontinence as well, and that the prolapse was kinking the urethra and preventing that being demonstrated, then you're not going to be very happy when you get in there and you do your, you know, you had your surgery and suddenly you're leaking, you know. So there's a whole process that is well documented, and then you've got someone who's operating and that's all they do. So they don't deliver babies. They don't do too much with management of hormones. They just really do repairs based on lots of research. What is the best sort of way of doing this operation? Okay.
Well, we're just touching on her approach, I think, of just starting at the bottom rather than the top level. And she did also say no amount of Pilates is going to reattach that muscle to your bone. But I mean, as we've talked about, you know, the use of language and kind of the finite, like you'll never and things like that, is just not helpful. And I feel like I went in quite experienced in this area, and I feel very saddened to think she's talking to kind of women that have had their first baby, are exhausted and tired and hormonal, and she's perhaps saying that to them. But yeah,
and I think the language does matter, and I think that's really important whoever you go and see. And I feel like it's taken a long time to develop that skill of trying not to be scary. And like I say to people, when a first edition of my surgical book, like literally, if you've got that, you've got to burn it, because I was very didactic with my, you must not do this, the rules of this and the rules of that. And so now, you know, edition four, like there, it's a totally different sort of kettle of fish. And I think that our role as physios is to try and teach doctors, you know, you hold a very high position and a pedestal here. So what you say is really matters. You've got to be careful, because that could be crushing. You see so many women have got these things. They walk in, they say that. And, you know, we're rehabilitating people for 6 months after about their mental health of what that meant. Mm-hmm. And so it really is important. Language matters. And I totally concur. If you don't get someone who seems to be connecting with you, then, you know, it's okay to go and seek someone else out and have a chat to them. And whether that's, it doesn't matter who it is, you know, I think it's really important to understand you've got to be careful about what they say. They've got to be listening to is a really important thing. And one of my favorite sayings is that, you know, the woman needs a good listening to, you know, it's not how much we've got to say sometimes, it's what we've got to stop and be quiet and listen to what they're saying and get an idea of where they're up to.
Yeah, that's a good one. And I guess I know you've got an appointment and we've got to run, but I thought I could talk to you all day, Sue. I think just if this has raised issues for people and they think, oh, God, that's me, I've got those symptoms, or I think I fall into that category, I recognise my own privilege. I've been able to pay for my consults and they're very expensive. And at the moment, I don't have private health, so I'm just paying the full amount. But if people are struggling financially, which so many people are, what's the best course of action for them? Should they see a GP? And you can get a number of appointments through the public system, I understand. Is that correct?
There are many public hospitals that have women's health physiotherapists attached to them, and that's totally free. Each state and city has their own protocol as to how you get that. So the first port of call will be to say, I've heard this, but listening to Sophie's podcast, I need to see a women's health physio, to your GP. How can I get that free through the public hospital system? There's another process where you can get what's called an enhanced primary care plan, or TCA, which I can never think of what they stand for, but the old name was enhanced primary care plan, and you get 5 visits, but you only get $56 back. That's a Medicare funded thing. So our consultations are long and they're complex and they aren't cheap, and so you will always have to pay a gap, but you will get $56 of that back from Medicare. You can, you know, do some research. It's just being careful about, you know, you don't, I think that individual assessment is really important. I think getting that internal assessment to say the extent of it and to really get that reassurance that this is not the end of everything. And I feel like that's a really important message, and particularly with prolapse. You know, it is really important to understand that only 15% of women go on to need surgery. And when they have their surgery, when they choose that, and I say to my patients, I fitted them with a pessary at 57. Look, if you can pack doing this, to changing it every 7 days, if it's a ring, taking it out, washing it, popping it back in after an overnight rest, you know, and you don't have arthritis in your hands, and you don't, you know, you can still manage to do it. 70 is the age where you've got to go and see a urogynae and say, look, you know, I'm sort of ready to talk about surgical options. And good urogynaes will say, you're in good health, your heart and lungs are great. Let's nurture you through this and see how far we can get you. And, you know, I think that's really important to sell the message. The good urogynaes are ones that are frantically busy and they're not doing a lot of operations. They're doing the operations that are necessary. So I really want you to keep thinking that it isn't always an operation, even if you have a significant prolapse. Sometimes significant prolapses can be held up magically by S3s, and there's a whole range of styles.
Yeah. Amazing. And we've touched on some really fantastic resources, and I'll document all of those in the show notes so people can click through to some of the things that we've mentioned. And I've got a free perineal massage guide to take you through that as well. So I'll put a link into that. But thank you so much, Sue. That was incredible. And I feel like I need to fly to Brisbane and have a consult with you now.
Well, lovely to see you. It's lovely to chat. So I mean, always anytime. I'm very happy to chat.
I hope you've loved this episode today with Sue. Be sure to share it with a friend. That's the best way to send the love and make sure that we're all learning more about these such important topics. And I know I feel like I've really looked into this area of health myself over the years, but I learned so much from Sue. So I really hope you did too. Make sure you subscribe so you don't miss any of the episodes. Next week, we've got another fabulous interview with Yara, and I'm sure you're going to love her insights. She's a psychologist who specializes in motherhood. And again, another beautiful episode where I learned so much. So I can't wait for you to be able to listen to that. So make sure you subscribe so you don't miss any of the episodes. And tell me what you liked about the episode over on Instagram. I'm going to do a little post of some of Sue's insights and a little video of her explaining the pelvic floor. So I'd love to hear from you over there, and I hope you have a lovely week.